Hello and welcome to the Palace Way Podcast. This is our first podcast for the 2025-26 season. A lot of changes here, of course. The biggest one being that we are now talking as supporters of a club that has won silverware with the reigning FA Cup champions, as well as being recorded on video. So you can find us on your YouTube channel for the Palace Way. If you'd like, you can see my Sampdoria classic kit with a very deep V, a little too deep, to be honest with you. I wasn't sure how this was going to go when I bought it. Or you can see the nice little eclectic background that Bruno has with his Palace vintage shirt. So without further ado, Bruno, how's the summer been? How are we doing? Welcome back.
I think it's fair enough to say this has been the best summer of my life, despite everything. You know, I still can't get over the absolute miracle that was the FA Cup final victory, and I'll be riding that high for as long as I physically can, or until we win the next one. So yeah, that's all from me.
Can't blame me there, man. I feel a very similar sentiment. And also with us returning, welcome back. The last time we were on this pod, he was with us as well, Bobby Manzi. Bobby, welcome back to the podcast.
Well, yeah, it's good to be back. Hope you all had a good summer and ready to enjoy the season. As FA Cup holders, I mean, it still just feels remarkable to say.
Yeah, and Bruno kind of alluded to it. It's an incredible feeling. It's something that whether you started supporting Palace last year or whether your grandfather supported it 50, 60, 70 years ago, we're all experiencing a trophy, a cup win, silverware for the first time. So Bobby, how does that feel going into this season? Do you feel that you have a little bit more leeway with the club? Do you hold us to a higher standard, or is it kind of somewhere in between?
I think it's really difficult to say where it kind of stands for the new season. I don't think I'll be able to give a definite answer on that until the season's actually got going, because I'm not sure it's quite sunk in yet that Crystal Palace are the 45th unique winners of the FA Cup. It's just that it just feels a crazy thing to say. In terms of looking forward to the season, I guess what you want to see is you always want to see progression. Now, I'm not quite sure what progression looks like when you've won silverware for the first time in your history. No day really is going to better Crystal Palace winning the FA Cup for the first time. I mean, Palace could go on to do crazy things like unspeakable, win a European trophy. I still don't think it will come anywhere near as close to the feelings that day at Wembley that Palace fans got to experience, just because it was unique. It was something that had never happened before. It was just, you watch your dreams unfold before your very eyes, and that was just crazy. And I just still think back to that day. I've not got the perfect words to sum it up, but I just find that really hard. It was an emotional day. I can't keep the secret anymore. I am a lifelong Crystal Palace fan, and being there with my family, my granddad, my dad, getting to see them after the game, it was just crazy. So yeah, it's just, God knows what this season's going to be. I'm just looking forward to it, and getting back to Selhurst, getting to Wembley for the Community Shield. That's another new thing on this journey, a European tour for a first time, whether that be in the Conference League or the Europa League. So it's just going to be very special, and it won't compare to last season and the way that finished, but it's just going to be one to enjoy. And I don't think Palace are in famous last words and any real fear of going down under this manager. And it's just going to be fun.
I couldn't agree more. Something that I didn't share last time we were on this podcast celebrating the FA Cup about a week after, and I feel comfortable enough to share it now because I'm fairly positive that my wife will never listen to this podcast. I did not cry on my wedding day, and I still consider that the best day of my life. I sure did cry when Palace won the FA Cup. So don't hold that against me, dear podcast listener. And if you ever see my wife, please don't tell her. I hope you won't. And I assume that you probably never will. But that being said, with that FA Cup win comes European football. Of course, it is supposed to be Europa League, but it could end up being a step below in the Conference League as Palace await their fate with CAS appealing the decision by UEFA. Bruno, let's go to you. Do you have any updates on this? Any opinions, anything that you think might happen, or any just takes that you might have about this entire process, which has been an arduous and, to be quite honest with you, a complicated and unnecessary one?
I think I've made my thoughts on it pretty clear on Twitter, in that I'm very frustrated with UEFA for a variety of reasons. Most of all, the pointlessness of the arbitrary deadline they moved forward, which has come back to bite us, and apparently wasn't even, enacted for Nottingham Forest, with Marinakis only placing his shares in Forest in a blind trust on the 29th or 30th of April, which will be part of our argument at CAS on Friday. You can talk all day about the logistics of multi-club ownership, or what decisive ownership is, or what role John Textor had, or deadlines. But at the end of the day, there is a difference in how Palace are being treated compared to how clubs of a larger stature are being treated, or how clubs who are owned by people with industry contacts are being treated, whether that's Marinakis and people he knows and owning Olympiacos, it's the City Group with Girona and Manchester City, so on and so forth. And of course, the awful quote from the head of UEFA saying that, we pretend in the cases of some multi-club ownership. Well, that's not multi-club ownership. And, if that's not corruption, I do not know what it is.
Yeah, I agree. I've had a lot of off the record conversations over this last week with people at the club, or just people familiar with football law and that kind of stuff. And the sense that I've been getting, and I know it massively sounds like a club brief, and it's not, because I've been asked not to share the details of the case, but Palace do have a confidence that they can go and be successful at CAS. They are very convinced of their case. When you look at the details of the case, I know there's been a lot of publicity over what Palace's arguments potentially are at CAS. Now, my understanding on that is what's been written in the press are supporting arguments, and that Palace would never be silly enough to tell everyone, especially UEFA lawyers, Nottingham Forest lawyers, Lyon lawyers, a couple of days before a court case, what their core arguments are. Now, I think from reading Mike Keegan's piece and hearing what I've heard about the arguments, is those supporting arguments are pretty strong. So if you apply the same principle, then their core arguments must be very good too. I think Palace have a very good case, but a very good case doesn't mean they're going to be successful. There's also the part of Swiss law where they give you, there's a kind of benefit of the doubt is probably the best way to pull it. And the principles of Swiss law and arbitration give Palace more of a chance as if it was just a black and white court hearing. Yeah, it's a difficult spell. I mean, I think, of course, this is a Palace side on things, but I think there is a massive injustice here. I think it is paints a very sorry picture for football if you are going to kick a team out who, for breaching multi-club ownership rules when they have never been part of a multi-club ownership operation. And even so, if you deem Palace to have been involved in multi-club ownership, frankly, they are not involved in that anymore, because John Textor isn't involved at Palace. He's not even involved at Lyon anymore. So there is a big case here as to building a picture of injustice. And I do think Palace have been hard done by. I think there is a good chance they go to CAS and win, but equally the reality of it is at the moment they are kicked out of Europe, and that could still be the case on Monday, and then they'll have to go hard in the Conference League.
Yeah, I mean, we've spoken quite a lot about what if, what like I'm always really dubious when it comes out that the club is confident, because we've heard that line plenty of times before, whether it's Wilfried Zaha's contract extension in 2023 or so on and so forth, or the first time with UEFA, right? But you're making me optimistic, which is probably a bad thing. Because a disappointed Bruno does tend to get quite mouthy on Twitter. But what I will say is, whether it's the Conference League or the Europa League, I don't think our transfer business has been sufficient for the squad that we will need at the time that we start playing in those competitions. And the fact that this case has been pushed back so much by UEFA, by the DNCG, by whoever it was at whatever time, goes completely against the purpose of moving the deadline forward to March 1st, and has likely harmed our transfer business and our ability to get players in through the door. Now, obviously, no one's come in and bought our best players, Eze, Gueye, who maybe we thought we'd have a sale of one of them, and that probably plays a role. But at the same time, if you don't know what your income is going to be from prize money or from TV money, because there's a big difference between the Europa League and the Conference League, if you don't know which competition you're in, because they can, it's a major pull difference between the Europa League and the Conference League. If you win the Europa League, you're in the Champions League, right? And players, at the end of the day, know more about the Europa League because it's been around for longer. These are huge factors in negotiating contracts with players, or quality of players that you're looking to sign. So We're being screwed over with the decision, we're being screwed over with the process. And then at the end of the day, there is no victim of this multi-club ownership issue reported here other than Crystal Palace Football Club. And that's why it would be an outrage for us to be permanently kicked out of the Europa League.
Ultimately, as well, in transfers, you've got a chairman who is now preoccupied with a legal case. I mean, I don't think it needs to be said that Steve is very hands-on with the transfers at Palace, whether that's funding on that and managing how much money is made available to Ben Stevens and Ian Moody, or whether it's actually giving the final sign-off of certain players and dealing with the manager on that. So Steve's very hands-on with transfers, but ultimately he's had to be dealing with lawyers all summer and building a case and dealing with UEFA. So that's been a massive issue in the transfer window. So I think once this gets out of the way on Monday, and we finally have that verdict, I think Palace will start to be a bit more active in the window. I don't think Palace's transfer business has been bad at all. I think Walter Benitez is an upgrade on Matt Turner, and I think Borna Sosa is a good option to have at left wing back. He less injury prone historically than Ben Chilwell as well. So there's an argument that can be made that that's an upgrade. And ultimately, if you look at the squad at the start of last season to the start of this season, they didn't have the left wing back there. So for the start of the season, on a pure numbers basis, I actually think the squad's in a much stronger position. They've lost Jeffrey Schlupp and Joel Ward this summer, so it's not like they've lost any big players. Ultimately, you look at the fact they've got Odson Edouard back, they've got Jezra Maxaki back, they've got Nairo Hamada back. I know these aren't the greatest players, but if you're talking on terms of pure numbers in a squad, Palace have got enough to deal with the start of the season. What I think they're looking for is three bits of quality in three areas of the pitch, and it's quite self-explanatory: centre back, centre mid, and an attacking option who can play across the front three to get them through Europe and be very competitive in that competition. Obviously, it doesn't help if they don't know which competition of the two they're playing in, because you can attract a higher calibre of players if you're playing in the Europa League, as Bruno rightfully pointed out. So that's not helpful. But they're just looking to cherry pick these three bits of quality for when they're playing Sunday, Thursday every week, that then they've got the deep enough squad. But for the start of the season, I think the starting 11's pretty set. I think they've got enough depth on the bench there. Right wing back is now an issue with Caleb's disc problem, and we don't know how long he's going to be unavailable for. But ultimately, I think some people have been making out that Palace have been suffering an apocalypse in the transfer window. But it's very far from that. They've not lost anyone. Oliver's biggest issue last summer was the fact he didn't have any players, or didn't have his main starters because of the international stuff. And then the transfers came really late. Now, if the transfers are coming late, but he's had his full squad, I don't think there would be any excuse if Palace went on the start of the season rather than losing the opening six games, because he's had his core to deal with all summer, as he's just looking for those three little extra bits of quality that between now and September the 3rd aren't really going to make a big difference. They're going to start making the difference when that season is in the thick of it. The other point to be made here is, as well, is the attacking option. While I think they need to be of high quality, especially with the unknowns of Franca and Essa at the moment, while I think they need to be high quality, I think they need to be high quality for December kind of time, when we're moving into the Africa Cup of Nations, when we're going to lose Ismaïla Sarr and someone like that, which is why I'm not convinced Gesson was actually the right move. And I know some people were quite agitated by that, but Palace didn't need another AFCON player, because that doesn't solve the problem of losing Ismaïla Sarr for a month of the season. So I think there's a lot more. I know I've said a lot, but I think there's a lot more nuance to the transfer situation than Palace just aren't doing business. You look at the other clubs in the Premier League who have spent more money. I think it's only Everton, of the clubs that you would say in comparison to Palace, who have spent money without a big sale this summer. Everyone else is in net profit. The Forest, the Brentfords are all in net profit from transfers alone this window. So with Palace not having that big sale, I don't see where the big outcry is for moves. Yes, the bit of quality would be nice to have at the start of the season, but ultimately, I think by the time we get to September the 3rd, Palace will have those three players.
I mean, if I had to play devil's advocate, I'd maybe say that the strategy hasn't changed then from last year. We've signed two players early days, like we did last year with Riyad and Kamada. And now we're sort of waiting for later in the window. And obviously last year we had those players who had international commitments, and this year we don't. but that's not an improvement in our handling of the window. That's just circumstance. So I'm not particularly impressed.
Is there not an extenuating circumstance in the fact that the chairman has been preoccupied with a legal case to try and get this club back into their rightful position?
You've walked right into my trap, because what I was going to say is most football clubs don't have such a centralized autocratic system where one man is responsible for all of the operations going inside of a football
But that
club.
one man being in control of all the operations at the football club has led to Crystal Palace winning the FA Cup.
I personally find that to be a kind of, catch-all argument that doesn't actually hold much weight, because we've won that cup because Oliver Glasner was our manager.
But
In
also, but Oliver Glasner doesn't come to the football club, and Oliver Glasner doesn't win the FA Cup if it's not for the good recruitment that has been ongoing for the last 4 to 5 years.
And that's where I will agree with you, but yet again, it shouldn't be one man handling all of those things. Yes, we've
But
won.
ultimately,
And
if
he
it wasn't,
deserves credit for that.
if the power wasn't centered with that one man, and if it was, I don't think it is as centered as that is made out, because obviously you had Dougie there, you've had Ian there, you've had
Then
Ben
why
there,
haven't we signed
doing the
players,
job all
right?
along. Because that's the whole money problem, right? And how the money and the funding is dealt with on the board.
But I thought it was to do with time because he's busy dealing with the UEFA league.
It's an absolute mixture of both. But if he's dealing with UEFA and then they're not able to sign a Europa League quality player because they're dealing with court cases and they're not sure what competition they're going to be playing, this all builds a picture of, well, Palace struggling to get the business done early. And I think we know with Palace anyway, it's not a surprise that they're going to leave the business late. Every summer this happens, that Palace leave it to the last 2 weeks. I don't think that's a shock. Oliver's got the players. He's had the pre-season he wanted. He's got a core of players that have just won the FA Cup, who are a very talented group. They just need a couple of extra players of quality. And I don't think that's absolute crisis going into the start of the season.
I agree with you. It's not a crisis. We've done very well. However, if you're looking at clubs in a similar position to us with uncertainty, let's look at Forest. Let's look at Lyon of all clubs, right?
They've
I'm not trying
Forest
to
have
compare our ownership to a club that's run by someone like Marinakis or someone like John Textor, but they've managed to get a lot of business done despite having to deal with a lot of legal work, especially at Lyon, right? Where you've
Forest of Ansaus and Marinakis, the club isn't set up in the same way where Marinakis is that controlling of it. He allows his recruitment department.
Right, but
But I
that's the
think
point. We
ultimately,
need better recruitment.
Palace is a very well-run football club, and they are very well run because of the way Steve Parish handles the club on a day-to-day. So I don't. Ultimately, you can't have your cake and eat it, right? And it's like, if Palace want to be playing Europa League football next season, maybe the chairman needs to focus on that and then deal with transfers. The court case will happen. The transfers will follow. I don't think it's a crisis.
I'd argue that if we're talking about having your cake and eating it too, I think Parrish is very guilty of that, given how he tried to have John Texas' money, no control, and yet it worked within Palace. But the second we got into a,
Yeah, but would you rather John Textor run the football club?
Oh, I wouldn't. What I'm saying is Parrish tried something cutesy where he'd get money without giving up control. And whilst I agree with the strategy, it came to bite us in the arse. And if we get away with it at CAS, fantastic. But it's been a bloody stressful process and nowhere near as clean as it could have been.
Ultimately, I think he's the way the football club is run is just him trying to protect the football club as best he can.
I agree with you there. Like, I can't argue with that. I just sometimes think there are, inconsistencies or inefficiencies, but at the end of the day, we won an FA Cup, and that's really hard to come back from as an argument if you're looking to like get to that next level. But I kind of think we've reached it now, so can we maybe think beyond the what can one person achieve over 15 years to what can a more, technocratic approach where we hire in more
But
people? We don't show you
what's the
yet.
response to that? Because obviously that would mean Parrish would have to come off the board and sell because of the way the shareholding's set up. It's like,
Not necessarily. I'm just saying hiring people on an operations basis, not a board level. So, we haven't replaced Dougie Friedman yet. That's possibly a factor. Obviously, who knows
I
how.
mean, I think it's quite widely reported that Dougie is still working at the club this summer. So
Absolutely. You still want to have a
It's not
long-term
necessary. It's not
succession.
necessary to re replace him yet. I think the club are looking at two options. They're either looking at a like-for-like replacement for Dougie Freeman. How you do that, I'm not quite sure. Or giving Ian Moody increased responsibilities at the football club and recruiting a chief scout, because ultimately a lot of Dougie's stuff that he was doing was the talent ID and Ian, I think, as I've reported and as others have now started to insinuate too, was dealing with a lot of the negotiations a lot of the time anyway, because he's a better negotiator and Dougie's a better talent ID and person to deal with the players.
For sure. I mean, like that's what we should be aspiring to get to is a slightly more decentralized model. I'm still fine with Parrish running it. He's done a fantastic job, and I'm a big Steve Parrish fan. I just sometimes wonder if we're talking about missing out on players, or just him being overly busy and focusing on one thing at one time and can't divide his attentions because he's spread thin. Maybe that is a sign you need to bring in other people to help you
I
out
also
to
just think there's a point that
perpetuate.
he's not released the finances yet for the recruitment team to deal with, and I just expect that to come after cash, because I do think there is, or I know there is, a fact of the club are just looking at the situation and thinking, when is best to move? Is it best to move once we have European clarity? Probably, because you can project revenues better. And also, it's like, if a bid comes in for Ebrecheze, for example, and Palace are forced to accept that, then Palace can do a lot more with the position. So all of a sudden, their 20 million that they want to spend on attacker, I'm just pulling figures out of pure thin air here because I don't want to say what the club are going to do, becomes 40 million because they've got more money to spend, and they can spend more money on centre back, and they can be maybe a bit more ambitious with the centre mid target. So they're just trying to wait for that clarity, and I think it's a fair strategy. And I can say I don't see the as big of a problem. If Palace, if we talk again at the end of the window, and Palace fall short with the business and don't sign a centre back, a centre mid, and a attacker unless they're creative with the centre back solution, and they say that they're getting Chaddy back at the end of September, and that Jefferson Lerma is now viewed as a centre back, which I think he is, and say that's centre back, then that's fair enough. And maybe there's a role for Mofi there to come in some European games. So maybe they could be creative with that and then sign the right wing back instead, because they don't know how Caleb's going to recover. But ultimately, if they get the three players, I think it's been a very good window. And if they don't, then it's the this question needs to be asked. But I'm not sure now is the right time to ask the question.
And yeah, these are all fair points. And let's go ahead and assume that the worst case scenario happens and we don't win this appeal. Taking the emotion out of it, taking away what is quote deserved unquote to us, just looking in a vacuum, we would be one of the favorites to win Conference League. I mean, you look at the clubs that are in it would be between us, Fiorentina, Mainz, who we just saw, and maybe Besiktas. I mean, I think we're a little bit better than Rayo and Strasbourg, so taking the pure emotions out of it and taking away what we deserve, if we do go in that tournament, I think we would be one of the top three or four favorites to win the entire thing. And I don't think that's arrogant to say. It's just looking at who is in that, looking at where we are, looking at the talent we have, the money we have to spend compared to the other clubs. I think it would be a shoe-in for one of the favorites. And I don't think that would be the end of the world. That being said, I want what's ours and I want what's owed to us. But I'm just, I think I've made my platform being a little bit of a glass half full guy, an optimistic type. So I'm just kind of being on brand here by saying maybe it wouldn't be the end of the world. And as we left off, we were talking about a little bit into the transfer saga that has happened with the Ivoirian from Nice, now a player at Aston Villa, Evan Gouessant. A little bit of a meltdown, shall we say, on social media about this transaction. Bobby, let's go to you first. Do you have any insight about just this entire saga? Do you think that we could have done more? Do you think we could have acted early? Do you think maybe it's not as big of a deal as some let on to?
I think it was an interest there from Palace to do it. I wouldn't say it was ever close, but there was certainly appetite from the player's side. He was interested. I just think ultimately, as I kind of said earlier, I'm not sure he was the perfect fit as such with the whole AFCON thing, and he could end up going to AFCON and that kind of stuff. Obviously, it would be a good signing for Aston Villa. I think Palace have got a couple more targets in that area that they will move on to. As I say, it's not one I was aware that he was a priority target, if you like, if that was, I know he was high on the list at Palace. He was interested, but it's not one that I ever just, I was never convinced it was going to happen, is the way I would probably put it.
It felt Nusa-esque, didn't it? It was one of those things where you like hear a name and there's not really many stories in the news about it. Obviously, we broke it. You get told a couple of times that you're close to going for a player and that the player's interested, and that's sort of what comes of it. I feel a bit bad because if I hadn't put that article out, we probably don't get a Twitter meltdown of such unbelievable proportions.
Look at that power.
But you know what? It's fine. We got
Go on. I was going to say I was remembered Pat's second point. I couldn't think of the question while I was talking. Yeah, I just thought the meltdown was really excessive.
Yes, no,
I just I think it was just entirely over the top. I don't think it's not a signing that's going to make or break the season. It's not like Palace haven't got players in that area of the pitch. I think we've spoken about it a few times already about how the squad's going to develop and how we do need an extra player in those attacking positions across the front line, and just it's a bit of depth. But I think maybe there's a couple of better options out there. If I was Palace, I would be going for Jonathan Rowe. It's not a name I've been told by the club that they are necessarily after. But I think personally they should have done that when he was at Norwich, and then went to Marseille. I think he's a very good attacker. I think he's capable of playing on the wing and up front. And I think he's a bit more of a narrow winger as such. So it kind of suits the Palace system of the two tens. I think he's got a lot of potential. Marseille are going to sell him for 6 million euros more than what they paid for. And I mean, I know they've only paid it this summer, but they signed him last year in effect. You are doing an overpay as such because of what you could have gotten from Norwich, but I do think he would be a very good kind of profile that Palace are after. As I said, I don't really want to say too much on the targets. I'm not entirely clear on myself on actually how they're going to act, but I do think he would be one they should look at.
Something that always happens every summer, and it genuinely used to bother me, and now I think I just kind of laugh about it because I do think it's a little bit comical, is 90 to 95% of the people that were really up in arms about this, I'm gonna say, did not know who Evan Gwesson was in June. And I think that happens every summer. We get fixated on this one rumor. And it's, oh, this guy's awesome. I saw these YouTube clips of him, or I looked at his stats. He was great. And then it falls through, and it's this heartbreak. And it's just like, you didn't even know who he was a month ago. And I'm not trying to, put down people and act like anything. I'm sure there are some people that follow different leagues and know who this person was, but I'm gonna say the vast, vast, vast majority did not. And I can promise you he's a good player. I'm not saying he isn't, but I can promise you that there is a handful of other players that can do the same job for us, especially with this manager who can just develop players. I mean, he's far more polished of a product than Ismaïla Sarr was last season. And Ismaïla Sarr ended up being one of the most threatening attackers in all of Europe's top five leagues statistically. And that's because of his work ethic, but it's also obviously because of Oliver Glasner. So fear not. If we do want to get an attacking player, there's still some out there that we can demorph and form and make into something good, and maybe there'll be one that we can actually have in January when SAR's gone and we need a replacement.
I think France is the perfect example of this. It's a story that I love because it was the first one I broke covering Palace that France's move was going to be done by the end of the week, and it was. I love that story. But the fanfare around him was remarkable for someone people had never really heard of. I mean, it was just the fact that Palace were picking a player out of Brazil, really. It's just that uniqueness of that, and so that not really being something they'd seen before. So yeah, fans do find a way, and this is just, it speaks to the wider impact of the transfer window now and how mental that is. I mean, I work in the industry and I just sometimes sit back on my evening and think, I scroll through Twitter and just think, what is this about? I mean, it's just crazy. I'd said it to Bruno privately. It's like fans were just so desperate for a new toy at the moment, and they were given the hint of one, and the minute that was taken away, it just caused pure meltdown, and you just lose all rational thinking. And when actually you sit back, and I hate to use the FA Cup win as the example, but you have that last season, and as I explained earlier, you look at the actual squad we have, and how a couple of players would just tip that over the edge to being a very well-rounded group. It's really not the end of the world. There will be another attacking target that comes. Every window, Palace miss out on a number of attacking players. 90% of the names that are out there, Crystal Palace Football Club do not sign. These things are put there for a reason, whether it's a smoke screen, whether it's whether it's an agent trying to force a move. Just don't believe, and I know I'm now doing a disservice to my trade, but don't believe everything you read, and don't be so obsessed with every single one player that the club might be linked with, because most of them don't come.
Yeah, it's a credit to Porto. I don't know if you guys saw this, but
Oh, it was so good.
They announced Luke DeJong signing by just having him run out of the tunnel during a friendly. Kind of a throwback to how things were before social media, and just a little kind of cool little tidbit that sees
Yeah, I
how
mean,
fans.
I want to be the guy that ruins every transfer story for the fans and gets there everyone and never have the surprise like there was with Michael Olise's contract. But watching that and the clips and seen from that, it was just remarkable. It was like, this is what football used to be. Or, you know, it takes you back to the days of Deadline Day on Sky Sports when that was the thing. And if you heard it on there, you knew it was right. Whereas now you've got hundreds of different mediums you hear things on. And you never know if it's true or not, really. I mean, I like to think 9 times out of 10, Bruno and myself tend to be pretty accurate, and that's nice. But there's just so much rubbish printed out there, and I've not actually reported on much this summer because there hasn't been a lot I can accurately, definitely say 100% is right.
Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a weird place at the moment where you've got David Ornstein crediting Indy Kyler for the first time. Or
That
you've
was brilliant.
I
I
just
loved
had
it.
to throw it out
It
there.
was proper full circle moment. It was like Indy Kyler had just been this hilarious account for years, and this summer is just on it with things. It was just mental.
I don't know how it happens, but I will say, I think the reason things like Luke de Jong and especially Michael Olise's contract announcement hit so fucking good when they happen. It's because of the state that news is in at the moment, where you kind of get fed everything. It's all some big dopamine hit, and people get so much joy out of it, or frustration. But at the end of the day, it's fun, no matter which way it swings. And it's amazing when it happens. But I also appreciate, like, getting a hint of things. Where it gets complicated is when it gets overly saturated with things that are simply unreliable. I've tweeted it enough times on the Palace Way that our followers will know. There are only a set amount of people you can trust when it comes to Palace news, and Sky Sports typically isn't one of them. There's a certain journalist at Sky who's maybe doing a bit of a better job this summer in terms of covering our cast stuff, regardless of past accusations of racism levied at well-known fans. It's a weird place to be. But at the end of the day, if you're listening to the people that you know regularly speak to. Oliver Glasner, people at the club, because they're, trusted Bobby, Matt Wisdom, etc. You're going to be in a pretty good place and get a balance and mostly truthful, telling of events.
Yeah, and that's why I consider myself a fortunate man to be sharing a podcast recording right now with two people that I think are credible sources. So I do appreciate the work that you guys always do. And we've been talking about incomings and potential there, but we haven't talked about outgoings much. And Bruno, I wanted to throw from you to you for that. About Gehi, about Eze, really with Gehi, is there any rumors going on? Where do you think the odds of him going are? And then I'd like to maybe give you a question of, would you be okay with him leaving on a free if he did stay with us and let us into our first European tour?
It's something I've really struggled to think about. I love Mark very much as a player. And because we now have video, I can actually show you this wonderful thing I have next to me. He is critical to our back line. He's our captain. We need to make money on him. And if an offer came in that meant we would make profit on the deal, I'd really want to take it. Obviously, it would have to be enough profit to make it worth our time, and provided that's not Chelsea, that should be quite easy, because they would be able to. Well, actually, it doesn't really matter. But Mark doesn't seem to have the interest he had at the start of the window. Clubs know that if they just wait it out, he's happy to wait, and he probably gets a better selection and a higher wage if he waits till his contract runs out. Alternatively, we really need to sell, so I think we're the ones who's being backed into a corner there. But worst comes to worst, we get Mark to lead us through our first European campaign, and that's not something I have a particular issue with. Eze, on the other hand, only has another week or so until his release clause reportedly expires, and that should hopefully give us a bit more power when it comes to negotiating with clubs. He, like Mark, is, a fan of the club and saw how Michael was treated and the good relationships that remain there. So, that's something to keep in mind, as we've put a lot of work into being a family club and a club where good intentions go around the board. And that is going to be inherent in any transfer business that goes on from an outgoing perspective.
My insight on Mark is that he is very relaxed about his situation at Crystal Palace this summer. ultimately for a couple of reasons. The first of which is that if he leaves the club on a free transfer next summer, he has a lot more options of clubs, and he gets his own signing on fee rather than Crystal Palace taking the fee. Mark has been on ridiculously low wages for a player of his quality for the last, I would say, 3 years now, because he's refused to sign a new deal, because ultimately he knows what the end goal is that he's going to be a top four player in whatever league he goes on to play in. So the incentive to take a signing on fee next summer is probably a nice one. When you've been on wages that don't match the quality of player you are. I mean, Palace have offered him a contract which would make him the highest paid player at the club. There has been talk about inserting release clause into that contract. Whatever Palace have come at him with, whether it's 1 year, whether it's 2 years, it has been a no. And from my understanding, I think that will always be a no, unless there is, a really weird world where you get a 40 million release clause where he takes 10% of the transfer fee, and it's just a stupid deal for him not to turn down, say, increased wages for an extra season. Now, I expect Mark Gay to be a Crystal Palace player at the end of the transfer window. Ultimately, because I can't see Newcastle coming in with a bid, because he has made it clear that Newcastle are not his first choice destination, just from, the way things have been conducted with Liverpool, etc. And I'm not convinced myself that Eddie Howe would want a player that doesn't have Newcastle as their first choice destination. He's very big on that, and I know they've fallen foul to it this transfer window with missing out on quite a lot of targets. But ultimately, it's probably a good way to run a football club, that you only want players who 100% want to be a Newcastle player. The other point to this is that we are in a World Cup year, and Mark Yeo at the moment, I know Levi Cole has just got injured, so it makes his life a little bit easier, but still, Levi was not the number, one of his top contentions for the England squad. Mark hasn't solidified that space as England's starting centre back under Thomas Tuchel. The first camp, it wasn't easy for him, and the second camp, he had the injury, so he's yet to actually know his clear role in the England squad. Now, in a World Cup year under a new manager who's only got, a year to work with a squad which is moving from era to era, which just feels bizarre anyhow. It's tough, and Mark knows he's going to need to be playing regular football wherever he may be. At Palace, as long as he doesn't get injured, he is guaranteed that. Whereas if he moves to Liverpool, where you've got Virgil van Dijk and Ibrahim Konate as the centre backs, he's not guaranteed to go in there and start every week. Whereas at Palace, he certainly is now. As a professional footballer, you would question them if they don't think, actually, maybe I can break into that squad and not have the ambition. But ultimately, you are going to the Premier League winners, and there could be a stage where he's on the bench a lot, and waiting for that opportunity, and he gets it in Europe and whatever you show it in Europe. But, these are all scenarios that he has to weigh up. And I do think it's tough for him to then walk away in a World Cup year where he would be. I mean, I think he's better than Harry Maguire. I think he's better than John Stones. I think. Ultimately, with the issues England have got at centre back now, with Harry and John not being the fittest or out of favour as such, he should be walking into that England setup. But he needs to be playing regular football to prove that. And I just think that's such a big point to this Mark saga. And if he can get the move on a free next summer where he has the choice of clubs, I mean, he's still the premium centre back on the market this summer, don't get me wrong. And maybe with Chelsea losing Levi now, if they choose to move for a centre back, they might look back there. But ultimately, I do think when you look at everything with a level head, I think Mark will end up being a Palace player come the end of the window, which is probably, from the club's point of view, as much as you want your captain there to lead you to Europe and another season with Mark is great, I think it's a big loss not to sell him this summer, because you signed him for around about £25 million. And a player you could have got 74 next summer, you're going to take a minus £25 million loss in terms of PSR, which is something that Palace haven't quite mastered, is the selling art of this model of when you invest in players at a young age and then you nurture them to a point where they are sellable, because you've just got them closer to their ceiling as such. Palace haven't mastered the point of selling that. Yes, you've got Michael, who they sold £50 million, but Michael is a £100 million player. So that is a loss.
Yeah, they were forced to because of the release clause, not because they
Yeah, the good ones, the good business is Joachim Andersson and Jordan Ayew, because you've used them for, the best spells of their career, and you've still made profit on them on the books. So that was excellent business. And then before that, you think, well, Aaron Wan-Bissaka. If I'm right in thinking that the sort of deal they made profit on or didn't
I think
make
it
a
was
big,
evened out.
yeah,
It
they
was
didn't
evened
make a
out.
loss, so that was okay considering how bad a spell he had at Palace. But yeah, they've not got this selling right at all, and that would be my one criticism that I levy at the club. But I caveat that with the fact of how well they've done, and they've given Oliver a squad that he is profoundly happy with, and that he's managed to go and win a competition, and now they could build on that and do, maybe win a European trophy this season, as long as they get those extra three players that I keep banging on about. So my elongated way of tackling the Mark one is I don't think he will go. But obviously, if a £50 million offer comes in, even 45, Palace will take it. And then it's down to him to whether he actually wants to move. Liverpool potentially would say yes. If it was a massive club on the continent, I think he would say yes. As long as he's guaranteed those minutes, and that's the situation where we're at with that at the moment. And on Ebbs, I don't see Arsenal paying the money for him, if I'm brutally honest. I just don't see that happening. I'm not convinced Arsenal have had any contact with Palace over Eberechiese. I'm not convinced that the agreement in place with the player is as true as it has been made out to be. I don't think Arsenal are anywhere near a deal for Eberechiese. And as it stands, I don't think it moves to Eberechiese going to Arsenal. With the release clause, I understand it's still to be active. There is, wherever you talk to, there is a discrepancy here, and I think that is just Palace trying to be a bit confusing with things, and the players' side trying to be a bit confusing with things, and just trying to blur those lines a little. But as far as I'm aware, that is still active. So a club could always come in. Tottenham, they've just lost James Maddison. Maybe they will come in, but I'm not convinced Eberechiese is convinced of a move to Tottenham, even though they have got Champions League football. I think Eberechiese is very happy at the football club. My understanding is that earlier this summer, Eberechiese told a number of his sponsors that he would be interested in leaving Crystal Palace Football Club this summer, which is where I think that Graham Bailey report came from about Palace. But him telling his inner circle he was leaving Palace. I don't think it was that he was leaving Palace as such, but I think as if there was the right offer there, he would move on, and he wouldn't be against that because he wants to compete at the highest level. He's got the taste of winning the FA Cup, and now he would like to win European trophies and win the Premier League. And I think that's totally understandable ambition. But if I was Eberechiese, I would be looking at the rest of my career now. And I'm not even saying this with a Palace hat. It's that if you move to Arsenal, if you move to, a club like that, you're not going to be their star man. You just look at the quality Arsenal have got in that number 10 position. Ultimately, you're not going to be starting there every week. He already is, I mean, the greatest icon to ever play for Crystal Palace, purely on the cup final goal alone. But he could just cement that legacy. And, if he leads Palace in Europe and, spends the rest of his career there, I mean, just what a story. The boy from Greenwich moved from QPR to Palace and just has the most remarkable career in South London. I would be very tempted by that. Wilfred should have had that career. I mean, he did 90%, but he could have ended his career at Palace if he, was a bit wiser with the move he made and not going to Turkey and chasing maybe a dream that was no longer there to be chased, even though he did score in the Champions League. I just think it's the perfect time for Eberechiese to sign a new contract at Crystal Palace and see his career out here.
Yeah, and with things standing right now, Palace have three out and out central defenders. I mean, your fourth is probably Jefferson Lerma, who's kind of that Swiss Army knife midfielder defender role. Klein's probably your fifth with really a converted fullback. So
Chaddy
as
Rehman.
we he's still injured right until mid-September. Is that correct, Bobby? Mid
So
late.
yeah, I think Chaddy is on track. I'm not sure on Jake. I haven't been able to verify that. But Chaddy, I understand, is on track at the moment with his recovery. And they're targeting end of September. Now, I assume that means full training at the end of September rather than
Yeah.
being involved in squads. But once again, that's something I haven't been able to verify.
So, as we've alluded, it's a little bit harder for incomings to happen when there's no outgoing. So, assuming we keep Gehi and assuming that we do need some central defenders, Bruno, as someone that has really an ear to the academy, are there any central defenders that could be coming up and potentially make that step up to the first team?
I have not been silent or even remotely quiet about my adoration of Mophy Djeminé coming through our academy. I mean, I've spoken about him for a couple of years at the end of season, actually, no, start of last season podcast on the academy. So the equivalent of this, I spoke about Mophy being our most exciting talent at the time, and he's had basically a full preseason with the firsts. Now, admittedly, that's been made possible by the way in which we've played games, the sort of 60-60-90-90 thing. But he's slotted in well in the Mark Guéhi role, you know, not without mistakes, not without the errors of youth, if you want to phrase it like that. But you know, he's got the physical ability, he's got the technical ability for the most part, and you know, he's a smart player. He's good on the ball. He's a modern centre back with height, strength, and speed, and he really excites me. You know, he actually reminds me a lot like a kind of weird mix of Chalobah and Van Dijk in like style. Now he's left-footed. He's obviously not that good yet, but the reason I say it like that is because Chalobah's, you know, a bit iffy in 1v1 duels, but very, very good at making recovery tackles and blocks. And Mophy has that same kind of profile of player. And Van Dijk, you know, stands tall, firm, n not afraid to put himself about, and not afraid to, drill passes into midfield or play long balls over the top. That's a lot more up Mophy's street. Is he either of those players yet? Absolutely not. Can he get there with game time, with trust? I believe he could. So yeah, if you need someone to step up from the academy, he would be the number one person I'd recommend. And you know, with other players like George King injured, I think he'd be the first name for Glasner to look to in that situation.
My analysis on Mophy is really basic, and it's that he's massive. I watching the pre-season friendly, I seeing him with the under 21s, you always knew he was big and was physical, but I always wondered how that would look in a senior game, and it just translated completely. I mean, he's huge. He's just an absolute physical powerhouse, and I think he I think he's got a good chance of making it at Palace. I don't think there's many at the moment in the that kind of age range who have got the chance of making it at Palace. I think a lot of them will make it, just not at the football club. But yeah, I think he looks decent. I would have liked to have seen him get a loan, but I don't know when that right time is because where he's had the injury and whatnot. So he's a tough one to deal with. But I think he's decent enough on the ball. We can drive forward. He's pretty physical. There's a couple of little nitpicks I would pick at his game, and a lot he's going to have to learn and develop. But there's certainly the makings of a very good centre half there, and I think he is. I think he's got quite a high ceiling. Is what I would say.
And he's had a really interesting development because he started out like at a pre-academy level as a winger, sort of moved more into holding midfield, and then got moved into defence kind of later on, I think 14, 15, before playing up an age group. He joined the 18s about a year earlier than he should have, or no, a year earlier than he would have. And he did very well then. I think Ed Ahrens put him as our most promising talent that year. So he's sort of gotten the accolades for a while, but you know, he's shifted through the positions, which is a pattern we've seen in the players that have come through our academy before. If you're looking at Wan-Bissaka, for example, or Deveni, if you want to say he came through our academy, but that's a different point. Mophy also has the mental attributes, which is something I didn't mention earlier. It's tough to step up and play at senior level and be able to rival elite athletes at the top of their game with the best mentality and fit into that group. And seemingly he's doing a good job at that. From a loan perspective, I think, you know, we all want to see him get one so we can watch him week in, week out and get game time. But, you know, it's about whether or not someone's willing to take a punt on a 18, 19-year-old centre back with no real experience at the highest level yet.
And yeah, this is the vision that we had when we started this academy is, we knew it was going to be a few years, and perhaps this could be the season where we see the fruits of the labor of becoming that Category One academy and kind of things working as they should. So that path to the first team is important, and I hope that he can be one of the first ones, not the first, but one of the first that really kind of has that success that a lot of us hoped would happen with our academy kids. Leading on to the Community Shield, as we've talked about, Palace going for possibly trophy number two. I'm going to start with my prediction. Perhaps it's a bold prediction, but I do genuinely think that Palace are going to win this, and I'll give you my reasons for it. At the end of the season, the last opponent that Glasner saw was Liverpool. He was very upset at the way we played in that match. And we have that quote from Glasner that's forever going to be in Palace lore, when we lost to Man City. And he said that, I'm paraphrasing, but if Pep plays the same way, he's going to solve it. I think that that is the style, that is the mentality that he's going to bring. I think he's going to demand a lot from these players. And I think he's going to have a tactical plan that's really going to confuse Liverpool and cause them problems in transition. And I genuinely think that we have what it takes to win this. I know it maybe it sounds a little ridiculous, but I don't think I'm being a fan and wearing my red and blue tinted goggles for this one. I really think I'm looking at it analytically, and I see a strong chance. So we'll play a little game here. Bobby, I'll throw to you first. Crystal Palace win the Community Shield if, I'll let you finish that sentence.
If they score more than Liverpool. No, I think in all seriousness, I think the Liverpool have got a big problem coming into the Community Shield, and it's that they have done so much business, and I think that carries its own weight of pressure. I think back to the year when Manchester City signed Haaland, and he just had an absolute stinker in the Community Shield. It just didn't fall for him one bit. I think there's going to be a lot of pressure on their new signings to kind of fall into place and everything to be right for the first game of the season. I'm not necessarily sure it will be for Liverpool. No, I think Palace have got a tough task, don't get me wrong. But I think they're probably going to be up for it a little bit more than Liverpool. I think Liverpool will see it more as the pre-season competition, and Palace will see it as another chance to win silverware. And I think you raise a good point about the last bit of the season and Palace having played Liverpool in such recent memory. And Oliver was very disgruntled by that performance. I mean, it was only him and I in the press conference after the game because everyone else was watching the trophy lift, and he was strong. I hadn't seen him that angry. He was very, very angry that the standards had dropped. His attack on the certain lines of players of maybe not putting so much effort in as they should have done, for a game that was essentially a dead rubber. You've never seen someone that passionate over it, which was good to see. And I think you'll be looking for a response from the players straight away, going into the season, winning silverware against the Premier League champions. And I mean, what a way to start the season that would be. So yeah, it will be a very good occasion. It's going to be an emotional one, obviously, with the whole Jota situation surrounding Liverpool. But I do agree with you that Palace will win at Wembley. That's maybe a slightly ambitious punt. I would caveat that with saying that there is a chance that Palace will do really well, and then maybe at the last 20 minutes, where Liverpool can make these five substitutions and just bring on their firepower, that maybe then that is where the game could go a bit wrong for Palace. But I'm going to say 2-1 Palace, with Daichi Kamada to score the winner.
Love that. I love that. Bruno, what do you got? What do you got?
I mean, like Bobby said, it's all about familiarity. They've got a completely new squad with a couple of imbalances there. We're likely going to start the same 11 that won the last time they played there, right? Because all those players are fit. So at the well, touch
It was
wood.
the lineup he played in the final friendly as well. I think it's
Exactly.
quite clear that's what he plans to do, unless
Exactly.
we find out of an injury somewhere that I've not heard about.
Yeah, and we're flowing with confidence. We're flowing with chemistry, and we know we can win at that ground against that team. With that team, and that's what I think we'll do.
All right. And I'm not going to give a score line because I'm terrible at that, but I think we're going to win. I'm just going to say I think we're going to win. Whether it's one
I
nothing,
think,
one,
yeah,
okay.
I say,
No.
I think we've all been quite optimistic with all of our Wembley predictions on here, if I remember rightly. So we're bound to stick that, or we have to stick that way because it's worked so far. It's been the winning formula.
Might as well.
I
Might
do
as
also think I've said Daichi Kamada score the winner every time we've gone to Wembley. Maybe it's a false hope in me.
Now you can be right at some point. Hopefully you
Yeah.
can put on his little tuxedo again afterwards and
He's
no.
just an unbelievable man. I think he's hilarious.
I love him. All right. And that's all the time we're going to have today, my friends. We thank you for listening to this first episode of the 25-26 season for the Palace Way Pod. As always, I am Pat, CPFC Tampa. I am back on Twitter. I'm on Blue Sky. Just find me, ask me questions. Be ready for the content that's coming out because I'm going to be coming back with some good stuff for you. Bruno, as always, we appreciate you coming on, spend the time.
Thank you very much for having me on my own podcast.
I know. You had to do it. You had to do it. And Bobby, you have any parting words for us?
Not many, just enjoy Wembley at the weekend. Anyone making the trip, I know that they've had the whole issue with the display, which is really disappointing. But yeah, just enjoy the day and up the Palace.
Up the past. Nothing more American than taking over some English guy's podcast, by the way. So that's USA right there, buddy. Up the past. Thanks, guys.